brain damage people in terms of their speaking capabilities, but it would be really, really neat. And yet there are a great many people in linguistics and in the humanities who would rather hear nothing less than that.
Lecture 3, How Language Changes, Sound Change.
According to most counts, there are about 6,000 languages in the world now. So we've talked about how language arose, but what we know is that that first language is now quite a few more. And the variety among those languages is truly amazing, much more in terms of difference from one another than just French and German, or even French, German, Russian, or even French and Chinese. The different ways that a language can be a language are truly awesome. So, for example, in southwestern Africa, in this region here, some of Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa, those of you who have the book can see this on the map, there are languages which informally are called click languages, or more formally Khoisan languages. And these are languages that have clicks in them. In terms of pop culture, it's known that certain African languages have clicks, but it's not always clear that the clicks are not decoration, they're not expressive, despite the fact that on the page, when linguists write them, they're written with exclamation points and crosses so that they almost look like profanity. But the clicks are actually just like consonants and vowels. They change the meaning of a word. So you could have a word like hada in one of them, and that means to swallow. Then if you put a click before hada, then it means to check out. And then there are different kinds of clicks. So it's not just one. There's one click language that has 48 different clicks, and the clicks are as important in determining what the word means as the difference between b, d, g, k, or t. And so, for example, in the Nama click language, hada alone means swallow. One click before hada means to check out. Another click before hada means to dangle. Another click before hada means to repulse, and so on. I'm not doing the clicks because they are very hard to master after one is a child. And to do it wrong would, to a click language speaker, sound as ridiculous as someone messing up our language, and I'm too shy. So, you get the idea. But that's pretty different. In Australia, there are various languages which, as verbs go, really they only have about three. There might be one meaning to do, one meaning to come, and one meaning to go. That's it. Everything else, you have to kind of talk around it. So you don't dive in the Jingulu language. You go a dive. Makes sense, but there's no verb for to dive. You don't sleep. Sleep is only a noun. You do a sleep. Only three verbs. So we would think, well, a language must have verbs. Yeah, some, but while many languages have thousands of verbs, some languages have just three, and Jingulu is by no means the only one. Then there are other languages where the whole conception we have of what a word is completely different. There are languages where what we think of as a sentence is one word. And so, for example, in the Yupik Eskimo language, if they want to say, he hadn't yet said again that he was going to hunt reindeer, for us, that's a lot of words. For them, it's tuntusukatarnik saitengiktuk, approximately. And so it's all one word. And it's not an exotification. It's not someone who's taking a bunch of words and making them all into one sentence to make the Yupik look interesting. They'll tell you, you know, just that one word. Their conception of how much you can put into a word is very different from ours. So there's all of this variation. And the question is, how did it get that way? And the fundamental insight is that language always changes, and it always has been. Now, we know that slang changes, but it's harder to always be aware, because it's as slow a process in some ways as mountains eroding, that everything else changes. And this includes meanings of words over time, this includes word order, and it includes how sounds work. And so this lecture is going to be about how sound changes. So For example, the basic idea comes in the fact that earlier stages of even the language that we speak are not really the language that we speak. So, for example, in school, we're often exposed to Beowulf, which is written in Old English. It's called Old English, but we have to learn Beowulf as if it were German. We wouldn't understand it spoken at all, for the most part. And even in writing, it's more or less opaque to us without extensive training. And so, for example, in Beowulf, if you have the book or you're watching this, then you can see a whole passage from Beowulf. But even so, the end of that passage is translated as the leader's accomplished courage. Now, for one thing, the language was different in that the word order was different. And so it was the leader's courage accomplished. And in Old English, that was the athelingus ellen fremadon, the leader's courage accomplished. Now, obviously, the athelingus ellen fremadon is not any kind of English that we recognize. The language has completely changed. Now, part of what the difference is because of how sounds change. And there are a series of sound change processes that are important in getting you not only from Old English to Modern English, but also from the first language to that Nama Click language, or the first language to Jingaloo with its small number of verbs, or Yupik. These sorts of things tend to happen again and again and again. They're not predictable, but they're explainable. That is, the same sorts of things always seem to happen. One or the other thing might happen to a certain part of a language at any given time. The same sorts of things seem to happen. There are certain things that do not happen, certain things that happen a lot. So, for example, one aspect of how language changes is called assimilation. And assimilation refers to the fact that two sounds that come together tend to start sounding more like each other as time goes by, kind of like one of those married couples. Either one sound matches the other, or the other sound matches that one, or they come together. So, for example, in early Latin, the word for impossible was impossibilis. In, and then possibilis. Impossibilis. As Latin goes on, it becomes impossibilis, and that's more familiar to us. Well, why did that happen? Why did the N become an M? Well, the reason was because M is closer to P in terms of what kind of sound it is than N. So there's N and then there's P. If you think about it, M is kind of like an N that you make with the lips. Mm, and so the N came closer to the P so that they could both be lippy kinds of sounds. So you could even look, as a linguist you get used to it, if it's in possibilis at stage A, you know that probably at stage B it's going to be impossibilis. There are other things that could happen, but something like that's going to happen when an N and a P get together. So impossibilis, that's assimilation of one sound to another. So in a way, it was laziness, if you will, that created impossibilis. And of course, we borrowed that word, not that we're going to give it back, and so we say impossible. But really, it's kind of a laziness of the mouth. Laziness of the mouth ends up driving much of sound change, not all of it. And as a result, you have gradually one language turning into another because the sound change has gone so far. Another process is what is often called consonant weakening. Consonants tend to weaken and disappear over time. So, for example, in Latin, the word for ripe was maturus. We have a reflex of that word in mature, maturus. Now, Latin gradually developed into a series of languages. Latin died, but it left behind French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Romanian, then lesser-known languages like Provençal and Catalan, and some languages that are even lesser-known than that. But the big five are French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and Romanian. Now, of those five, certain consonant weakenings tended to happen from Latin, as we would expect. And so if Latin had maturus, in Old Spanish, the T between the A and the U weakened into a D. If you think about it, D is kind of a softer version of a T. And here's where it helps if you're understanding sound change and language in general to get away from the wonderful alphabet. The alphabet makes it look like there's some special relationship between C and D, not really in terms of where sounds are pronounced in the mouth. D and T are versions of each other. D is here in the alphabet and T is here, but we're going to take the alphabet and we're going to throw that down. We don't want to think about the alphabet. We want to think about our mouths. And so, maturus, then it becomes maduro. And so it becomes a softer version of itself. The S at the end of the word disappeared. So that's what it was. In Castilian Spanish today, there's been even more of a transformation. So it's not maduro, it's maduro. That's the famous Castilian th. And so t, d, th. Now, in another one of Latin's products, French, in Old French, the word was madur. And so from maturus to madur. And goodbye to the S and not even a vowel at the end. Now, after that, the th dropped out completely. Consonants not only weaken, but they disappear. And so you had something like maur, and then the vowels coalesce. Today, it's just mur. And so from maturus to mur, completely different words. And that was just partly because of what happens to consonants over time. That's a normal language change process. And if you looked at mur now, if you didn't have any written records of Latin, you might not be able to figure out that that used to be maturus and now it's just mur. That's how languages change. So there's nothing exotic about that. For example, things like that are even happening in English. There's the word bottle, and you think about the way it's spelled, B-O-T-T-L-E. But we don't say bottle. We might imagine ourselves saying it, but imagine somebody in a parking lot saying, why don't we get some bottles of beer? It would be somebody who was either, you know, pretentious, foreign, a Martian, you know, that's not anything anybody would do. The word is bottle. And if you think about it, the sound in there is a lot like a D. And so that's happening there. So maturus, maduro. Bottle, at some point, bottle as time goes on. This is a natural process in human mouths. So consonants weaken. As you might think, vowels weaken too. So there's a process that one would call vowel weakening. And think about name and think about the way it's spelled. N-A-M-E. Now, we English speakers are used to this silent E. But really, what's interesting is that you can imagine that that E is there for a reason. Nobody writing down a language where the word was name would for some reason stick on this silent letter just to annoy people. And of course, it is that the word actually was once pronounced name. And then it weakened to nama with this kind of indistinct sound that's called a schwa. And pretty soon, it was gone. The spelling preserves this older situation, which is very quaint and sweet, but it's also kind of a pain. But it shows that vowels weaken. So what you're seeing here is that, in a way, laziness, or what is politely called the principle of least effort, has an awful lot to do with how languages evolve through time. Now, once there is writing, and especially once literacy is widespread, these sorts of things don't happen as fast as we'll see in a later lecture because people have this sense of the right language being what's on the page. And so there's a resistance, especially as people become more educated. But most languages are not written. Out of the 6,000 languages that there are, only about 200 are written in any real way. Most languages are purely oral for all extents and purposes. People don't think of them written when they speak them. And sounds just change as they always have. So, the question arises, however, if that's how sound change works, then why don't all languages just devolve into mouths full of dust? If that's what happens, if it's a matter of maturus down to mur, then it would seem that there'd be something kind of missing after a while. There must be something more to keep things going. And part of the answer to that is that vowels don't only weaken and disappear, they have a way of shifting around, and that's a normal process too. Within our lifetimes, that is a lot of what we hear as people's different accents, and I mean in particular native accents. But over time, it can make a language very different from what it once was. And an example of that is something which is called the Great Vowel Shift. And that name makes it sound like something happened one day. But actually, it was a gradual process that we can see starting to take place in the late 1300s. But it transformed the vowels of English, and it made it somewhat unlike the languages most closely related to it. And what's interesting is that our spelling, to a large extent, reflects what the language was like before that shift happened. Once the shift happened, that created much of why English spelling is such a tragic mess. And to understand this, we have to understand how sounds fit into the mouth. And so, it's about vowels. Now, for us, vowels are presented often as A, E, I, O, U. And it's okay to think of our basic kind of linguistics vowels as, think of it as the Spanish ones, if you've had experience with Spanish. A, E, I, O, U. But, now you have that. Once again, you've got that order. That order is arbitrary, though, so we don't want that. Take that away. We're going to leave that here. Now just think about the vowels just swimming around as in a soup. It happens that they fit in your mouth in a particular way. This is quick linguist conception of vowels so you can understand the great vowel shift. So if you say E, notice that the action is up here, top front of the mouth. So E's not in the middle of the alphabet. E is up here. Notice that if you say oo, in a way, it's like you start with E and then pull back. E, oo, E, oo. Both of them are at the top of the mouth. So I and U are not those letters in the alphabet where U is a slightly strange vowel way over at the end. Nothing to do with that. I is here and U is back there. E, oo. So there you go. Now, then there's A. A is not for us at the beginning of the alphabet. A is actually kind of in the bottom of the mouth. If you go ah, notice it's down there. So there's E, U up there, and then A, which is down here. So if you imagine the side of the head, you have E, U, A. That's how linguists think of these sorts of things. Then, if you think about E and O, well, they're between E, U up top and A at the bottom. So you can go E, E, A, and notice that you're pulling your tongue down successively. In the same way, go back, U, O, A. O's in the middle. So what you have facing you guys, if you are using the DVD, is a kind of a triangle where it's an inverted triangle where you've got I and U at the top, A down at the bottom, and then E and O in the middle. So that's how vowels work inside of the mouth. Now, here's how this relates to the great vowel shift. Think about the word food. Now, we as English literates look at food, and we see those two O's, and we think, well, food, because that means U. Why, though? Now, think about Spanish. A, E, I, O, U. Now, what person who spoke English sat down and wanted to transcribe food, that word, and decided to put two O's together, which looks kind of like food? Why didn't they make it a U? Wouldn't that have been easier? Shouldn't it, to us, it would look like FUD, the way things have changed. But if it's a Spanish-speaking person, it would be FUD. Well, how come they put those two O's together? What kind of sense does that make? It doesn't. The reason that it's F-O-O-D is because at the time that it was written down, it was FUD. It was actually a long O, and so FUD. Now, remember where O is in the mouth. You've got U, O, A. What happened with the great vowel shift is that a lot of sounds started moving upwards in that sense. And so things that were O started going up into the U world. And as a result, a word which began as food became food. It started out as what was probably processed as a bit of an accent. So food, 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 pretty soon it was up there. The spelling stayed F-O-O-D, but we pronounce it now food. That was the great vowel shift. Notice that you have a word like feed. Once again, if you want to transcribe E, why two E's? Because if it's in Spanish, then E is a nice I. Well, then what is the E's? It looks like fade, if you think about it, and it was. But then you have E, E, A. Well, what was fade moved up. So just like food became food, fade became feed, but the spelling stayed the way it was. So the language really changed. There was a time when to feed somebody was to fade them. And then, many generations later, it was a matter of feeding them. That's a very different way of pronouncing it. Now, that happened to many vowels, and as a result, you had the great vowel shift. One more. Notice that name is spelled nama. Now, then the a moved up into the a slot, and that's why it's name instead of nam. And so you have this process where vowels moved up. Really funny things happened up at the top. And as a result, you have a whole different vowel system. And that is a kind of language change. And vowel shifting, not exactly what happened in the Great Vowel Shift, but this kind of vowel shifting continues today. So for example, I spent several years out in California. And this is not limited to California, but it's where I first noticed it. What is written aw is pronounced ah by increasing numbers of people. So I had some friends. My name is John, and then there was Ron, and then there was Sean, and there was Dawn. To me, I grew up in Philadelphia, it was John, Sean, Dawn, and Ron. To many of the people out there in California below a certain age, we were John, Sean, Don, and Ron. So what's sushi? I say sushi is raw fish. A lot of them would say raw fish. I had a girlfriend who wanted to become a lawyer. She used to talk about how she wanted to make laws. That's not an extreme accent. You might not notice it, but gradually you realize that that aw is changing to an ah. I want to make laws, she used to say. Now she does. And she also had that change. It is a shift that we're seeing, and it's becoming more and more prevalent in many parts of the United States, making laws, eating raw fish. Many people who talk that way don't notice it. If you're teaching linguistics classes and you're teaching the sounds and you're teaching aw, it's become a problem with a lot of kids like that because they're not quite aware that raw fish is not what is indicated in the spelling. And so they'll come up with these transcriptions. But that's because the language is changing. Very interesting. And so it's constant, these sorts of shifts. And when you combine the consonant weakening and the vowel weakening and just these shifts, you get some wild things. So water in Latin was aqua. Now, one ordinary change for something like that is Spanish, where it's agua. So aqua softened into a g. There's a relationship between G and K that the alphabet kind of obscures. So agua. But in French, the consonant disappeared completely. And so you have awa, and then there's just this kind of vowel shift. The word is spelled in modern French, E-A-U. It's pronounced O. So you go from aqua to O. If only French existed, you'd never know where it came from. And that's just the way languages turn over. Now, I'm giving you here what are kind of linguistic textbook examples, but in this series, I have wanted to give a slightly more global perspective on languages, just because language is a worldwide phenomenon. And you don't want to stick too much to good old Western Europe, because if you do, it's giving a kind of an artificial sense of what a language is. It's like saying, this is a series about the animal kingdom and only doing mammals, as if there are all these other things. So sound change not only does the sorts of things I've just shown, but it also produces tone. There are many languages in the world where the pitch that you utter a syllable on makes complete differences in meaning. And I think most of us know that Chinese is that way, but it's actually very common worldwide. It's all over Africa. It's very common in East and Southeast Asia in particular. There are Native American languages of Mexico that have this. Tone is as important to many languages as prefixes and suffixes are to us. It's a very ordinary thing to happen. But you would wonder, how would that happen? And so, for example, in Chinese, specifically Mandarin Chinese, there is a word, ma. Now, for us as English speakers, that's it, ma. And we're hoping that you put a plural ending on it and you have ma's or something. But no, Chinese doesn't have a plural ending. Chinese isn't about endings and prefixes. It's about tone. And so if you have a high tone on ma, and so something like ma, then that means hemp. If it's low tone, ma, then that means scold. If you have a tone that makes a kind of a swoop, something like ma, then that means horse. And if it's a different tone, then it means mother. And so that syllable can mean all of those things based solely on that melody. So whenever you listen to Chinese people speaking, they're doing that, which is amazing because it doesn't seem to take any effort. For them, it's very natural, but tone is how these languages work. And actually, this kind of four four-level difference is gentle as tone goes. In Cantonese, there are, depending on how you count it, six. Now, I could try to be more dazzling and say Cantonese has nine tones, as many people do, but that it's a little forced. But they do have six. So, for example, fa can mean share, powder, advise, divide, excited, or grave, all depending on the tone. That's what Chinese people are doing when they talk. But the question is, how would that start? You know, just like you would not listen to the word food and have these two O's to indicate ooh, that can only happen by accident. There must be a reason why that happened. In terms of tone, if the first language is emerging and people are putting names to things, however it happened, we really don't know. What are the chances? And we don't want to be ethnocentric and suppose that there's something more normal about our European languages, but what are the chances that people would decide, well, ma is going to mean hemp, and ma is going to mean scold. You wonder, that wasn't the first thing. You get the idea that developed somehow out of the first thing. And it did. And it did in a very interesting way. Suppose that you have three words in a language that doesn't have this kind of tone. Let's say that they're pa, pak, and pas. Now, what's true about that is that there's pa. Now, if you say pak, there's a tendency for that vowel to rise a bit in pitch, especially compared to if you go pas. So, pak, pas. It's just a little effect that those two final consonants have. So, you might have pa, pak, and pas. Now, to us, we hear the K and the S at the end, and then the one with nothing at the end, and that's the difference. So, imagine that pa means mantelpiece, pak means camera, and pas means radio, something like that. So these are different words. But there's that little tonal difference on there. We wouldn't think of it. In a language at that stage, they don't either. But remember that consonants weaken. They always do, no matter what kind of language it is, no matter what kind of person you happen to be, rainforest, tundra, Mars, you are going to have consonants weakening. So with pa, pak, and pas, it's delicate because those consonants are in danger. They might fall off. Well, in this case, you've got pa, pak, and pas. Well, if the consonants fall off, then you've got pa, pa, pa. The consonants are gone. Now, this is very gradual. It's not like somebody wakes up one day and asks mommy, where are your final consonants? It's something that gradually happens. They change first, then pretty soon younger people are leaving them off most of the time, older people a little less. But eventually, it's at the point where you've got pa, pa, pa. And then, if a linguist goes into that community then, well, what is your word for this? Well, it's pa. What's your word for that? Pa. What's your word for that? Pa. Oh, you've got tones. That's how that starts. And so sound change creates tones. Isn't that beautiful? And so there are many languages in the world where you have that kind of thing. You wouldn't notice it happening, but once it does happen, you've got this brand new situation. And then remember that it's not always just three. There are languages with seven, eight, and depending on how you analyze them, nine tones like that. And for them, that's very ordinary. In many languages like this, most words are only one syllable long. So in a way, you need this because there are only so many da, fa, gi, bi that you can have. And yet, they are going to talk just like we do, and they're going to be able to mention giant squids washing up on beaches. And if they're going to do that, then they need a lot of words. The tones can do it too. So there are languages where those tones are very important. So what this means is that what we process as little wrinkles like raw fish are actually symptoms of a language that is gradually turning over upon itself and becoming a brand new language. And so if somebody in Philadelphia says bad instead of bad, we as human beings naturally think, well, she has an accent. And then there are all sorts of social evaluations we might put on it. But actually, if you take, for example, somebody says bad, and there are all sorts of thoughts we might have about what kind of awning that person has and what kind of car they drive and, you know, what they put in their hair. But imagine if the difference between bad and bad was a tribesperson who comes from the rainforest in Malaysia. So we don't know anything about them. We just know that in one village people say bad, and in the other one people say bad. Well, it happens that bad is changing into bad, and pretty soon everybody's going to say bad. And pretty soon, if you want to write down what the language is, you're going to write bad somehow. That's how languages actually change. So, In general, it's interesting to notice about how sound changes that a lot of that impacts on how we evaluate language and how we kind of analyze ourselves when we speak. So, for example, there is library. There are people who say library. It has a certain association, but library is a rather awkward word in some ways, and library is really kind of a natural outcome. It's our social evaluation, the existence of writing, that make us feel like it's somehow wrong. Another one, this is just for me, February is a deeply annoying word. It should be February. And at some point, I think most of us probably said that. Then you learn that you have to say February if you want to get a job. But February is where that word really should be going. And if we were rainforest people and we didn't write this language, it would have been February 500 years ago. That's how sound change works. So sound change is not the decay of language. It is actually one of the generators of new languages.
Lecture 4, How Language Changes, Building New Material.
We should return to this question of why language doesn't just wear away into a pile of dust. Part of the reason is that sounds don't only wear away, but they change. But that's not completely it. Still, it might feel like we certainly lose a lot of material. Why wouldn't it be that things wear away and some of the stuff changes, but after a while, the stuff that's being changed wears away too? We have that same problem. The answer to the question is that languages are always building themselves back up by creating new words and endings while all of this erosion is happening. And it's a process that can be called grammaticalization. And as a matter of fact, it is called grammaticalization. And as a discrete topic, this has only been being discussed in linguistics extensively for about the past 25 years. So you're getting cutting-edge material here on how language changes. But basically, a language is always developing new material at the same time that it's losing it. And to understand grammaticalization, we have to understand that there are two primary classes of words. There are concrete words, and then there are grammatical words. Concrete words refer to objects, actions, concepts, or traits that any of those have. And so, it's nouns, it's verbs, it's adjectives, it's adverbs, it's the kind of red meat words. And so, man, happiness, run, overrate, red, distraught, quickly, words. Concrete words. Then there's what I think in a folk way is often called the little words, grammatical words. These are the words that relate the concrete words to each other, or they situate a statement into time or space, or they convey an attitude. So the man didn't even come to the building. What's even? Well, it conveys an attitude. It's a grammatical kind of word. So prepositions, articles, conjunctions, interjections, auxiliaries. So in, under, but, hey. So those are your grammatical words. The, would. Those are grammatical. So a fundamental process in how a language changes is that words that start as concrete ones become grammatical ones. So it's one thing to say that Adam and or Eve said that thing is called a zebra. But how would that process apply to coming up with something like but, as in no ifs, ands, or buts? There's nothing to point to call it, and it's kind of hard to talk about if you don't have a word for it. Those words tend to come from concrete words changing into grammatical ones over time. Classic example of this is the French negative marker pas, spelled P-A-S and pronounced pas. Now, in French today, you might say il ne marche pas, and ne and pas are both negative. So he doesn't walk, it's he not walk not. Il ne marche pas. Now, where did that come from? It's very interesting because It used to be that pas meant step, and it still does in expressions like pas de deux and things like that. But then there's this other meaning of pas. It used to be that French was more normal in terms of negation. You just put your negative word before the verb, and you didn't need something hanging off of the end. So just like in Spanish, yo no hablo, I don't speak. No, just there. There's no pas. In earlier French, it was just, he doesn't walk, il ne marche. And that was it. Pas had nothing to do with it. Pas came in for a very specific reason. There are always times in language where you want to add a little bit of paprika to a statement. And so you might want to say, he doesn't walk. You might want to say, he doesn't walk a step. And if you said that, then you would say, il ne marche pas. And so it didn't mean he doesn't walk. It meant he doesn't walk a step. Now, pull the camera back. That was not just one thing. That was a general process in the language. And so he doesn't eat. Il ne mange. Simple as that. He doesn't eat a crumb. Il ne mange meat. And so you'd stick that. He doesn't drink. Il ne boit. Doesn't drink a drop. Il ne boit goutte. So you just did that. That was a way of kind of exaggerating or making a negative expression colorful. But then something started to happen. Generally, when you have a colorful expression in a language, over time, its punch starts to disintegrate. And so, for example, I remember, I'm 38, I remember when people started saying awesome, I think it was in the 70s. It generally referred to something truly amazing. It referred to, say, Star Wars, whose special effects at the time were fantastic. It referred to if this enormous yak came walking across the schoolyard 50 feet tall and made a big hole in the ground. Not that that happened, but that would have been awesome. Nowadays, people use awesome to refer to scrambled eggs. That's because that word has kind of diluted in meaning. That's a normal kind of thing. Peachy keen used to be something people would say with a straight face to mean something that was really special. Then it became something that was kind of nice, like you got the car for that night. Then people stopped saying that at all. There's always that kind of devolution. Lame. To say that something was lame in the 60s and 70s was pretty nasty stuff. Oh, he's lame. Now kids use lame just to mean that the chair has a spot on it. That's lame. It's because this is what happens to expressions. Now, in the same way, these French negative expressions kind of lost their mojo as time went by. So this business of he's not going to eat a crumb, he's not going to drink a drop, those kind of tended to drop away. These things have a lot to do with fashion, really. But with pa, something funny started to happen. It started weakening, so to say, il ne marche pas. It used to mean he's not going to walk a step. Pretty soon, it weakened to the point that saying il ne marche pas basically was just saying he's not going to walk, and the whole notion of emphasis started to kind of go away. So very gradually, it got to the point that the pas didn't really feel like it meant step anymore. It felt like, really, it was just helping the ne mean not. So il ne marche pas. Pretty soon there was a generation who felt that il ne marche pas meant the same thing as il ne marche. Habits are habit forming. Pretty soon, il ne marche pas was the way that you said it. Now, of course, no person is going to think, my language should not have the two negatives. You just speak. And so, il ne marche pas. So, what that means is that if you look from one end to the other end, you have this word that means step of all things. It means something that you do with your feet. And suddenly, it's something that helps you to say not. It's a very normal process. That's a grammaticalization. Step is concrete. That's something that Adam could have given a name to. Pa is not. It's a grammatical word. Adam and Eve weren't going to discuss what are we going to use when we're trying to deny the truth of a proposition. That's a grammatical word. And so that's how these sorts of things form. And it goes on and on and on, this kind of grammaticalization. For example, in modern French, there's a difference between written French and the way you really speak French. If you are going to go into a French-speaking situation and you're going to be an actual human being, you can't walk around always using the ne. One of the fastest things you learn is it's not il ne boit pas, he doesn't drink. It's il boit pas. That's normal. The minute you do that is when somebody realizes that you can at least halfway speak the language. To always use the ne would make you a robot, would make you very stiff, and that's accelerated over the centuries, although it goes way back. So that means that if a Martian came down and transcribed French the way it's actually spoken, and nobody knew the Martian, let's say it's an invisible Martian, so nobody can see the Martian writing and then start sticking in the ne to sound proper. Just the Martian goes around, invisible, writing down the language. The Martian would think pa was the only negative marker. So il boit pa. The Martian would say the way to make a negative is to put pa at the end. And that means the process is complete. So that is grammaticalization. And it's something that doesn't only happen in Europe. It's not something that only happens with written languages. It's not something that happens to languages that are spoken by certain people. It happens all over the place. And so, for example, the Mandinka language, which is spoken in a large region of West Africa, is a language where there is an equivalent to our will, as in I will go, and it's Sina. Well, where did will come from? Well, what's very interesting is that there is a word si that means sun, and the word na that means come. Sina originally comes from sun come. The way it happened was that there was sun and there was come, and that became their word for tomorrow, because tomorrow presumably is when the sun comes. People said tomorrow I go so much that pretty soon it just became a word meaning will. And so will starts with sun and come. Sun and come could be named by the first people. Nobody could name a will. The will has to come from something that begins with the concrete. So that's where that came from. Now, grammaticalization is not only something that creates a word like pa, but it also is what creates most of our prefixes and suffixes. So once again, you have that person creating the first language problem. Let's say that you don't know anything about English or French or Spanish. You are one of the early people. You're sitting under a tree. You probably don't have anything on. And you're trying to figure out how the first language is going to be. Very hypothetical. But would you stick endings on? Like, you know, I speak. How likely is it that you would say, well, we're going to say I speak and then stick something at the end. Yo hablo. Tú hablas. You speak. If you think about it, although we're used to dealing with that when we English speakers learn other languages, that isn't what you'd think of at first. It's the sort of thing where you know that that's probably the result of some series of accidents. So, as far as that goes, those endings are kind of like the male anglerfish. Way down in the deep sea, there are these fish. The female anglerfish is much bigger than the male anglerfish. And as a matter of fact, after the male anglerfish has enabled breeding between the two of them, the male anglerfish comes up and sucks onto the female anglerfish's forehead. And gradually, he becomes thinner, and his eyes wear away, and he just kind of becomes a pimple, and that's the end of the male. The male serves one function. The female is the going concern in the anglerfish world. In the same way, endings in a language start out as free-swimming words, and then those words kludge on to the end of another word and wear away, and they're kind of like the male anglerfish, and they become just a bump on the end. What in the world am I talking about? This is what I mean. So, for example, if you are dealing with Latin, well, Latin has got endings. And so, for example, amo, amas, amat. I love, you love, he loves. And Candide, amo, amas, amat, amamus. That's the one musical theater reference I will do in this series. So, you've got those. Well, that is something which has a source in what started out as free words. So, for example, there were endings like that for the future. I will love, amabo. You will love, amabis. He will love, amabit. And so you have these future endings. So, those were fine, but just like in English, there are lots of ways of expressing the future. You can say, I will love, I'm going to love. There's another way of expressing the future as Latin developed, and especially in colloquial Latin. And that was to say what in English would be, I have to love. For us, that means I must love. In Latin, to say I have to love was another way of saying that you were going to do it in the future. And so, for example, you'd say amare, to love, and then habeo, I have to love. So amare habeo. Now, habeo conjugated, and so habeo, I have, habes, you have, habet, he has. And so it would be amare habeo, I have to love. Amare habes, you have to love. Except it didn't mean have to, it meant will. And so you had amabo on the one hand, that meant I will love. Another way of saying I will love would be to say amare habeo. Now, that was the situation then, but people said amare habeo a lot. It became the more common expression. And when expressions are commonly encountered, then sounds tend to wear away faster than if it's something that's only said occasionally. So just like I'm going to is really pronounced colloquially, I'm gonna. Well, amare habeo became amare habeo. And gradually the habeo or the habes or the habet became just an ending stuck onto the end of the word. So Latin became, among other things, Italian. And the future in Italian is not anything like amabo, it's amero. So amare habeo became amero. And then you have amerai for you and amera. Those have a source in what were free words. They were swimming like the male anglerfish, and then they just became pimples on the, shall we say, end of the word. And so amero, amerai, amera. So that's how the suffixes developed, these future suffixes. And even in Latin, if you have amabo, I will love, that had started out as a free-swimming item. In the ancestor to Latin, and we'll talk more about that later in the series, which was Proto-Indo-European, don't worry about that for now, it was am, to love, and then the bo came from a word buo, which meant I am. So I am to love in Proto-Indo-European was one way of saying I will love. The buo became bo, amabo, but then Latin came along. There was this different way of use of indicating the future. These new endings started. That's something that happens as time goes by in a language. And so all these suffixes that bedevil us when we learn a language like French or particularly Spanish or Russian are ones that originally were words. That's where they come from. So it's not that somebody makes them up. They come from this process that has a way of recycling itself. And sometimes grammaticalization can go so far that it leaves behind bits of things that we don't even really think of as suffixes at all. So for example, think about words like nibble, dribble, dabble, jiggle. Now, I don't think we necessarily spontaneously put those words in a class, but they've all got that ol on the end. Now, if you think about it, there's nibble, and then there's nip. There's dribble, and there's drip. There's dabble, there's dab, there's jiggle, there's jig. In particular, think about dribble and drip. Something drips, it goes twip, twip, twip. If it's dribbling, it's kind of faster, tighter, kind of like a hummingbirdy kind of thing. If you nip something, you probably do it once. If you nibble, you're probably kind of rabbiting it. You're rabbiting it. You don't nip something many times. Nibbling is not just going, you're kind of going, that kind of thing. To dab is maybe, dabbling is like, so you have this ol. That ol means to do something many times quickly within a set amount of time. There are little suffixes like that that are much more alive and much more immediate to speakers in many languages around the world. We used to have one of those. And if you notice, that ol still has a meaning, like cackle. We can't cack now, but still cackle is a kind of a it's not a ha, ha, ha. Or babbling. Again, babbling is rapid-fire trivial exchange. Now, it's been so long that it's not a living ending anymore. We could not say to laughle. Although, you can imagine what laughle might mean. It would be the difference between ha-ha-ha and ha, and that's because the ol has kind of a meaning. But really, it's dead. That comes from what we can imagine was most likely some free word, now unrecoverable, which kludged to the end of words and had that meaning. So that is a product of grammaticalization, and it's something that happens throughout the world. And you can even see things like this happening with tone, so that we're not Eurocentric. It's something that tones create as well. So, for example, there is a language of Southeast Asia, which is called Lahu. Lahu is one of Chinese's relatives. And in Lahu, there is a word to eat, which is pronounced roughly tsa. And this is a word which used to have a different rendition. You would eat, or you could make someone eat. In other words, you could feed them. In order to make them eat, you put an S prefix on the front of it. And so you'd have tsa, and then you'd have sza, and that would be to make them eat. Now, there was a tone on tsa, and then there was a tone on tsa still when you put the S in front. Putting the S in front tended to mess up the tone. And this happened in different ways in different languages like this. But you have tsa, and then you put the S on the front, and it'll come out something like sta, and it's different. Now, the S wore off over time, because sounds tend to do that, and then that just left a changed tone. So it used to be at stage one that when you eat, you tsa, and then when you make someone eat, it's sta. But the s is what you're paying attention to. But then if the s wears off, then at stage two, when you eat, you tsa, and when you make someone eat, you tsa. And so now just the tone change makes the difference between eating and making someone eat. Or you putting on your own clothes and you dressing someone else. Or you drinking and you giving someone something to drink. All based on it's just a melody for them. And that's a kind of a grammaticalization too. Because what started out as a little concrete piece of something is now just completely abstract. So grammaticalization works in those languages too. So that's a major aspect of how we get new stuff. Grammaticalization takes free words and wears them down into grammatical words, or often just appendages to other free words. Those appendages often gradually wear away, or they lose their meaning, just like we now have to be told about that little ul. We don't think about it. But then there are always new things like this that are always coming along. So there's kind of a cycle. It happens with prefixes and suffixes and various other aspects of language. And in the meantime, another way that language doesn't wear down to a nub is because something happens that's often called rebracketing. And rebracketing is what happens when speakers start to have a different sense of where the end of one word and the beginning of another is than was originally the case. And so what I mean by that, for example, is that the word for my in English used to be mean. And so if you're familiar with German, it's like mein, mein Herr, my sir, and then mean. That's the way it was. Now, if you had a name that began with E, then just like you might say something like, my Francesca, you know, please thatch the roof, or something like that. You might say, if the word is mean, and you're talking to Ellen, mean Ellie, why don't you go churn the butter? If you're talking to Edward, mean Edward, why don't you pick the lice off of that thane over there, whatever people were doing. And so, mean Edward, mean Ellie. But then mean became my. You know, we know that the word that is possessive in the first person singular is my. So it's my house, my lice, my beach ball. So it's my. But that means that if you listen to somebody saying, for example, mean became mine after a while, so mine Ellie, mine Ed. If you listen to somebody say mine Ellie, you might think, well, if the word is my, well, then that means that the person being spoken to is not Ellie, it's Nellie. My Nellie, my Ned. And that's how those nicknames started. If you think about it, if Ellen is Ellen, where do you come up with Nellie as the nickname? What's the N? It's one of those things, you wouldn't do that on purpose. You know, what are we going to call Ellie when we want to be really fond of her? Nellie. That makes no sense. Or particularly Edward. You have to be told that Ned is a nickname for Edward, because it really doesn't make any sense. That's because the N at the end of the old mine got caught there. So, oh, my Nellie.
Well, once the word is my, then the N must belong on the front of Ellie, especially when literacy isn't as common. So this is just a kid listening. Goo goo ga ga ga, my Nelly. Come here, Nelly. And then it gets stuck in the language. So that's a kind of a re-bracketing. Hamburgers. You know, we have, I think we might vaguely sense, well, there's Hamburg, which is this town in Germany that, you know, you probably don't want to go to. And then there's hamburger. And then we know that there are these things called burgers. And nowadays there's like fish burger and sawdust burger and eggplant burger and all these different things. Burger is this patty of something. And that's what we think. The word used to be hamburger steak. The idea was that this particular brown, chopped up, unhealthy meat that tastes good was something that had been come up with in Hamburg, and it was hamburger steak. And, of course, naturally, people started calling it just a hamburger. But, for one thing, we don't care about Hamburg. And another thing is that there is a meat called ham. So if you're not really thinking about it, and we all have a lot to think about, so why would we consider this? You might think, well, yeah, so it's a burger made out of some meat, like ham. But if you do think about it, a burger made out of ham would be kind of a salty, disgusting sort of thing. It'd be kind of like gilding the lily to have a burger of ham. You don't want that much ham at a time. But it sounds just plausible enough that people began to think that it wasn't a hamburger, because it's not as if when you look at it, it immediately screams boring town in Germany. You think it's ham burger. Next thing you know, you've got this whole new noun. Now, we might think, well, then it's not a real one, but we're only thinking that because we have the page and because there's smarty pants like me pointing these things out. If we were in a rainforest speaking an unwritten language, nobody would remember that there was once something called hamburger steak, and burger would be a word. That sort of thing happens all the time, and so that's why there can be a fish burger, which would have made no sense to someone back in the 19th century who was still thinking about hamburger steak. They would kind of take off their top hat and scratch their nose and wonder what a fish burger was. It comes from Fishburg or something like that. So that is another way that we develop words. And you get things like alone. We think, well, he was the lone dissenter or something like that. And then you think, well, then alone must be kind of like a bubble or a going or something like that, alone. But that's not how things happen. Why would the A be there? Actually, alone started as all one. So you're all one. You're one and you're on your own. Pronounce them together often, you get this one word. So all one, with allowances made for how those words were actually pronounced, all one became alone, alone. Now then you start thinking, well, since there are various words like a twitter and a flutter that begin with this well, then it must be alone. But there's no loan. The word doesn't trace back to earlier forms of English. Loan is something we perceive because that's how the word sounds. So what this means is that languages are full of what are, in essence, mistakes of this kind. For example, habeo kludging to the end of amare like that is really laziness of tongue in a way. If somebody had been inclined to, they could have said, I don't like the way these kids are doing that. But it happened. And it's the same thing with hamburger. Nickname begins as roughly ick name. And then you'd say, oh, it's an ick name. It's an ick name. But it kind of sounded funny because that word ick, which was actually E-K-E, ecka, passed out of the language otherwise. And so what's the ick? And so then, well, it sounds like, well, then maybe it's a nickname. So an ekname became a nickname. And so now there's this N where there wasn't one before. So you think about it, what's nick about the name? It's never made sense. If you stop to think about it, you know that there, something weird must have happened. And the weird thing was a re-bracketing. And so it happens all the time. If you look in the American Heritage Dictionary, and you look at where an awful lot of words come from, or any dictionary with pretty good etymologies, you see that the history of a language is, in its way, a kind of chaos. And once again, once writing starts, this becomes less likely to happen, except around the edges, such as in popular culture, and that's why hamburger seems a little bit tardy to us as opposed to core aspects of the language. But in terms of languages as they really change off the radar screen, this is the way new things always happen. And so we have a hard time processing it in our life. Only written documents or careful deduction can show us how natural these sorts of things are. So what you have seen is part of the study of language change. And I feel responsible for saying that that is something that linguists do other than etymology per se, which is just butterfly collection.